here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I'm the author of the News Dissector blog on MediaChannel.org. I'm a filmmaker. I'm a troublemaker. I've been in the media for a long time. I used to be on WBCN in Boston for 10 years, and now hopefully you'll find what I have to say interesting here on BCN, the PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. The number to call, 888-874-4888. Welcome to News Dissector Radio.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo's Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express, and these are Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we
Well, a little rough start there, but we're here. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on News Dissector Radio. Please stay with me. The number to call, 888-874-4888. And I want to welcome my first guest, Phaedra Ellis Lampkins. Phaedra is the chief executive officer of Green for All, which is redefining the face of environmentalism. She's led Green for All on several groundbreaking policy victories at the federal, state, and local levels. And she's also promoting and supporting the march, the One Nation March, that I'll be attending in Washington tomorrow. Welcome, Phaedra.
Hi, this is actually Phaedra's communications director, Ricky Weisberg and Dege. Phaedra had to jump off. I'm so sorry.
She had to jump off a show that she had committed to be on.
There was urgent marching matters.
Urgent marching matters. Well, we'll have to defer.
200,000 people coming to D.C. We have to run for a second. I am so sorry, but I'm here.
Well, it's okay. It's okay. Well, you know, what can I say? This has been my experience with One Nation. Marvin Bing, the director of it, was supposed to come on twice. He didn't come on. And all I'm trying to do is support this effort. So I appreciate that you're there. There's actually a person there to talk about what's happening in Washington with the march, as far as you know, right
now. Well, we appreciate you covering the march because we really need it. The march is doing great. We have people coming across the country on buses into D.C., and the signs are being picked up today, and there's a lot of buzz in D.C., and I think, I mean, it is the most progressive march in the history of the United States. We have, I think, over 300 progressive organizations have promoted the march. Everyone from the SEIU to the NAACP to, you know, to Green for All, to the organization that we work for.
So what are the principal demands, if you will, of the folks who are coming to D.C.?
Sure.
I mean, I've heard it described really as a jobs march, with the labor unions basically defining the message here. I also noticed that there will be anti-war activists present, and now, you know, your organization, which is really pushing for a green economy, not just, you know, jobs per se, but green jobs.
Exactly.
So tell me about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, jobs are obviously a priority in America for all Americans. So that is really a baseline, you know, demand that we're asking for. We're calling for 1 million jobs. And why Green for All is involved is because we're working to build an inclusive green economy, which is exactly green jobs, like you said. You know, we also have other, basically the march is for jobs, justice, and education. And so that's basically what we've been boiled down to, being able to bring together all this huge coalition of the most diverse organizations in the country. So, you know, calling for jobs, justice, and education, we think those are really the foundation of what the American dream is, and it's really about the American dream.
But when you say we're calling for 1 million new jobs, who are you calling to create those jobs? Are you calling on industry? Are you calling on the government to do it? In other words, we all want more jobs, but there are reasons we don't have job creation going on. Part of it has to do with, you know, the disaster that Wall Street left the economy in and the Bush policies and all the rest of it. So just a call for something, is this utopian or is this practical?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a mix of both, probably. I mean, I think it takes everybody's, you know, it takes public will to be asking for the right jobs. And, you know, what we're talking about at Green for All is not just a million jobs that are just, you know, that are in the utopian vision, but green jobs that are good for the planet and are good for the people. You know, the Recovery Act started that, and we need to push farther, and we have to talk about how we can create new jobs and, you know, transition other jobs into the green economy. And I think there's a lot of opportunities coming up for that.
Well, listen, you know, I'd just like to say I support this call, so to speak, but I'm worried about it, in part because, you know, the Republicans and the right and even some members of unions, you know, are basically saying, you know, the government can't create all these jobs, and business doesn't seem to be willing to. I mean, many major industries have trillions of dollars stashed away in cash and are not creating new jobs. Don't we have to do something about the nature of this economy and try to bring it under some control? I mean, the crimes of Wall Street have not been prosecuted. The Obama administration has followed a very centrist approach with Larry Summers, who's left, and Christina Roma, who's left, and Orsag, the budget director, who's left, and now Rahm Emanuel has left. What is left? What do we actually expect now from the Obama administration in terms of progressive initiatives on the economy? Because, you know, it's hard to see where it's coming from right now, with Congress in total disarray, with the Republicans resurgent, with the Democrats sort of being compromising on everything, or many of them, not all of them, certainly. Where is the leverage to create these kinds of new jobs? And I agree with you, by the way, if you don't fight for what you want, you get what you don't want. So
right. We always say that if you're not at the negotiating table, you become the meal. That's what we say at Green for All.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's obviously not a great environment in Washington, D.C., but there's a lot that's being done nationally and on the state and local level, which is something that Green for All does. I mean, we work with community organizations, we work with labor groups and city governments to try to make sure that the stimulus money that they receive goes to low-income people, people who really need it when they create green jobs. So
listen,
while it's important
to
hold the officials accountable, obviously, we need to hold the president accountable, we need to hold the Congress accountable for what the American dream is, you know, to be able to have a good job in this country.
See, I think you're missing part of my point here. Part of my point is the reason we're in this mess is not just about politics. It's about power. It's about economics. It's about corporate greed. It's about corporate crime. By the way, Sherry Welch is joining us from Atlanta.
Sherry.
Happy that
Hi,
you're
Ricky.
Here. You know, Sherry is a strong supporter of Green for All and for green jobs. But this is the dilemma we're facing now, is who are we fighting? Are we fighting the Republicans because we want more Democrats in Congress? Are we fighting Wall Street? You know, and it seems like the rhetoric about fighting Wall Street seems to have been sort of downplayed here. Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong. But I also think, you know, this is that the progressive movement is in trouble. And what the march is trying to do is trying to bring together all of these people in one place at one time to start that conversation. It can't just be this person fighting for this person fighting for that. You know, when people are acting in their own silos, you know, for green or for labor, you know, it just doesn't progress the agenda. We need to all work together, and that's really what the march is trying to put together.
It's really a launching off point.
It's a starting point for something that's going to be happening.
Sherry, did you want to comment?
And as your founder, Van Jones, one of my heroes, as well as a hero of the planet, said, November 4th, 2000 was not the finish line. That was the beginning. And this is why I'm such a huge fan of your organization. If you could tell us a little bit more about the funds that y'all have secured for job training and guaranteeing broad access to clean energy jobs that Green for All has done, because the march will be over on October 3rd. What's in its place, Nikki? What can we do then?
Sure. Well, I encourage everyone to go to onenationworkingtogether.org, and they can sign up there to find out what's happening after the march, because that's really very important. You know, there's going to be a lot of civic participation activities that are going to come out after that, after the march, and ways of staying together so that we can really build this progressive agenda. And then as far as Green for All is concerned, I mean, we've had a lot of different wins on different levels, and securing money for green jobs training programs. I think our work in Portland is really impressive. It's one of the things that it drew me to the organization. In a city like Portland, it's an interesting example, because it is actually a city that's probably the whitest city in the entire country.
Are you talking about Portland, Oregon, which
Portland,
I used
Oregon.
To live in?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Portland,
yeah,
Oregon.
It's been green forever.
Mm-hmm. There is a Portland, Maine, you know.
There is.
Yeah.
Okay, let's not leave them
I'm
out.
I'm not going to forget
so,
them.
Okay.
What is different about the approach of Green for All compared to other green groups, Ricky?
Well, what we're trying to do is trying to change the face of environmentalism. You know, we're trying to change the face from, you know, what it looked like in the second wave of the environmental movement, which was, you know, the founding of the EPA and, you know, kind of white upper class, middle class people. We're trying to show that it is, you know, everyone from Black Eyed Peas, we go on tour with the Black Eyed Peas, to, you know, a great local activist named Marquise Bryan in Atlanta, who just organized our first college ambassador program on historically Black colleges and universities. We really target making sure that people, low-income people, and communities of color not only understand what's going on with the green movement, but they can access the green jobs that is building the clean energy economy or the green economy. So what's different about us is really this being able to reach to minority communities and educate and mobilize and get them jobs. That's what's different about us.
See, I hate to say it, but what I have fear, and having been a marcher all of my life, you know, starting in the civil rights movement and actually helping to organize the original March on Washington in 1963,
Wow. We
know that a march in itself brings a lot of people together, you know, gears up the base, and then what happens usually is nada. You know, there's very little follow-up. People are exhausted in just doing the march. There's no organizational concept that is really there to get people to join. You know, I mean, the right wing came up with this Tea Party thing. They got a lot of support, obviously, from billionaires, from people who are using populism for their own interests and the like. But it seems like progressives don't have an ability, you know, to kind of mobilize and work together in some kind of ongoing organizational structure. You know, the MoveOns of the world are there to raise money for politics. They're not really remaking our politics. And this is something that I would urge the green movement to be a spark plug for, to try to see if we can't build an ongoing structure, an ongoing organization, some kind of movement that will go beyond this one march. You know, because this march is going to happen in 2 weeks, Jon Stewart's March for Sanity and Colbert's March for Fear are going to be in the news and all the rest of this, and then the elections will take over and be the story, and everything else will be forgotten, unless we in some way try to do something about that. And that's my sort of outlook on this, but that doesn't mean I'm not taking part. I am. I will be in Washington, and I believe in it, but I also believe it doesn't go in the past, certainly not given the lessons of the past, anywhere near far enough to actually cohere a structure. You know, we need organizing into an organization, not just organizing for an action. Mm-hmm. That's my take on it anyway. But listen, I really appreciate you coming on and subbing for Phaedra. Give her my best. Tell her
she sends her best.
Sometime in the
so
future
much.
We can maybe debate these issues more. And of course, Van Jones is an old friend of mine, and I appreciate you know, the work that you do. I want people to know about it. Is it greenforall.org?
Greenforall.org. That's
there you
exactly
go.
Right. And you can follow us on, you know, Facebook and Twitter. We're at greenforall. And I encourage people to sign up at onenationworkingtogether.org as well, because this is just the beginning. There is going to be a coalition that's been working together on this. It's unprecedented to get all the CEOs of all these progressive organizations in a room every week to talk about their agenda. And this is just the start.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us again. again, 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector in this new time period on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be here until 1 o'clock, or rather till 2 o'clock, I'm sorry, from 1 to 2. I'm new in this time period. I'm just getting into the rhythm of it all, so please bear with me and bear with this program. Thanks for joining us very much. My next guest actually is taking a slightly different tack on all of this. Ted Rall, he was on last week talking mostly about Afghanistan, and Sherry pointed out to me, hey, you have this great cartoonist, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, twice a winner of the R.F. Kennedy Journalism Award, and a brilliant writer, and you didn't ask him about his new book. So you've got to have him back on to talk about that. And what he's written is an anti-American manifesto. How does that jive, Ted, with this march in Washington here? Is this a one nation or is this an anti-nation approach?
Well, I think these marches they're cute.
Cute?
Yeah, they're cute. I mean, it's sweet, you know. It's great.
People are pouring their hearts into this. I mean, people are getting on buses and going to Washington, disrupting their lives.
Yeah, hoping, and they're wasting their time and their energy.
That's what you think?
Yeah, totally. I do. And, I mean, I'm saying this as someone who used to do this.
Okay.
I went to Solidarity Day in Washington in 1981. I've been in riots in front of Gracie Mansion during the early 80s. I've done this whole routine, this whole protest thing. Now, I mean, all you have to do is look back at the mother of all protests post-1960s, which was the anti-Iraq war protest, to see how effective peaceful protest is. I mean, the only protests I've been impressed by in the recent past was the Battle of Seattle. And if the organizers of the anti-WTO movement marches had their way, it would not have worked because there would have been no broken windows at Starbucks. It was the only thing that actually accomplished anything. So I'm just unimpressed.
I'm not sure about what it accomplished. I mean, it did put the issue, on the agenda, and but basically the WTO protests have sort of fallen off, and for many of the third world countries who came to Seattle to try to have their day in the sun, so to speak, to negotiate on their issues, they were disappointed. There was no alliance really between the American activists and the people from the third world who came there. I mean, I'm not totally enamored with militancy for its own sake. Trash at Starbucks window, to me, does not change make. But there is an anger out there. There is a frustration out there that's not being really spoken to by this big Washington jamboree. And I think it's all well and important to raise that. Now, what is your manifesto here, Ted? Tell me about your book, because I don't want to forget talking about it one more week.
Okay. Yes, I need to sell books. So,
okay, I understand.
Let's talk about them. The Anti-American Manifesto is a call to arms. And it is a call to reject the two-party system, to reject the capitalist system, and to talk to those Americans who understand that the American system of government and its economic system are completely and totally broken, unfixable, unreformable from within, and to have them understand that we are back at a revolutionary crisis moment the way we were in the 1960s. So that we now have an opportunity, again, for the first time in 42 years, to try to wipe the slate clean and fix this mess we've got. I mean, we've got Barack Obama, who is probably the best that this system is going to give us. We're not going to get a president who's more progressive, who's more liberal, who's smarter, who's got a more liberal cabinet. Ain't going to happen, not from the system. So what we've seen is that he has failed. He is unwilling or unable, as the case may be. I'm not sure which. I don't think it matters which. But he is unable and unwilling to change the basic structure of the society. He is, there's $1.4 trillion for bankers, not a dime for someone who's about to lose their home.
All right, but let's
priorities have got to change.
Let's take that on, because I share your frustration. I've written a book, The Crime of Our Time, about the crimes of Wall Street. I've made a film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, to try to, rouse the public to act, to demand indictments and prosecutions of these people, to try to basically talk about the injustice of it all. And, frankly, as eloquent as I think I am, okay, it's not having the impact that I would like it to have. People are not rallying behind it. We went to this march in Washington when they were organizing it, offered to show Plunder it, for free at whatever organizing efforts to try to make this part of their plan. I was basically, nobody called me back, essentially. It was sort of thought of as sort of excessive and extreme. And that's just sort of enforcing the law. That's not like breaking the law and trying to create new laws. I mean, the problem with the revolutionary rhetoric is revolution is war. Revolution is a battle. It's not a dinner party, as Chairman Mao said. It's something where you actually go into the streets, you go into a battle. You can do it nonviolently, as Gandhi did, organize a mass movement. You can do it violently, as many of the liberation movements have done in Africa. You can do it through negotiations. But you have to organize. You have to have a base. You have to have a revolutionary army, or a force, at least, to fight for your values. Right now, calling for a revolution when the right wing seems to be so much better organized than the progressive movement seems to be a prescription for disaster, because these people, have managed to, because they have a media support network and Fox News, right-wing radio, and the like, they are able to, in a sense, define the issues that are being debated and being discussed. And as a result, progressives can't even seem to put forward a message that's clear, except, you have 14 progressives, you have 28 position papers, okay? Everybody pushing in their own way. So
yeah.
You need some sort of unity here.
Well,
I don't see it.
The problem is that the trend is getting so... I don't see the progressive movement becoming more organized. I see it consistently. I'm 47 years old. I've consistently seen it get less organized as I've gotten older.
Is that because it's just incapable of building, a structure to move forward? I mean, this is,
I don't think the left really exists, to tell you the truth, in the United States. We don't have a left in the way that European countries have a left. We can't call national strikes.
Consider 11 million people supported a national strike in Spain this week,
right.
And it got zero coverage, basically.
And in France, national strikes are pretty normal. And we don't have any labor movement here. We don't have any, we don't have any truly progressive movement. And I think that what passes for the left, like the move-on types, and they're really just sort of self-perpetuating liberals. They're not really, trying to change the system radically. They don't question the basic assumptions of society. But the idea that, say, a Bill Gates should rake in billions of dollars a year while people starve on the streets. I question that.
I question it too, and we're going to get a chance to question it a little bit more after this break that we're going to have to take right now, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Ted Rall. Also coming up in the next half hour, Aaron Crown from mi-implode.com, a leading site about economics, and we're going to hear from, I hope, Alan Grayson from Florida, a congressman from Central Florida, who has put forth a really interesting analysis of the foreclosure fraud crisis that really deserves to be heard more. So that's coming up in the next half hour of News Dissector Radio. Thank you for being here. I know Gary Null fans are probably tuning in and saying, who's this guy? I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Stay with me.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid.
empty wallets, empty shops, and bank walking to AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible to the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in America.
40% of the station carries no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by Coke, by Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
Selling attitude like food for the masses. Junk consumption, we are lumping. Just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched, the bill's attached. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news, good. What we need to know.
News Goo, a great song based on my book, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, by Polarity One, who also did the song about Plunder, my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. And so we try to have music that's relevant in our program, and we'll have some more. Ted Rawl is still with us. Ted, you know, you're indicting the entire country here. You're saying that we're responsible for more war, corruption, and brutalization of the planet than any other force in human history.
That's right. I mean,
is that correct? Am I quoting you correctly?
I mean, I think that's history. Yeah. I mean, I'm a student of history, and I have a hard time figuring out how Genghis Khan or anyone else matches up to the United States. I mean, the bodies are piled up higher here than in any other regime in the history of the world.
Sherry, do you agree with this guy?
States of America is the biggest terrorist on the face of the planet.
Whoa. So we're indicting the United States. We're urging people to check out Ted Rawl's Anti-American Manifesto, his new book. At the same time, you know, when you raise these kinds of issues, people turn on you. I've just had an experience, Ted, last week I wanted to tell you about. You know, I'm on Facebook, and so I got a friend request from a guy, Abdullah blah, 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 who is in Afghanistan, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which I Googled and found is like the Taliban.
Yeah, it is the Taliban.
And he basically is, you know, I went to his wall on Facebook, and it was, you know, we killed so many imperialist forces, we used IEDs, it's a completely talk about anti-American, it's anti-Western, anti-NATO, anti-Karzai, you know, anti-corruption, in their view, and what have you. And so I was faced with this choice. Do I friend him or not? So I put a little notice on Facebook. You know, now the Facebook movie is opening tonight, so this is sort of relevant to talk about. And I basically asked for advice from my other friends on Facebook. And I was surprised to get 58 comments, okay? Some of whom said that if you friend this guy, you're going to end up on a no-fly list. You could be spending Christmas in Guantanamo. Okay. And, you know,
hey, well, you know, Cuba's nice in the winter.
Well, it seems like, you know, we're living, there's a book that was written under Saddam's time called The Republic of Fear, describing his administration. It seems like that book could be rewritten today about the United States, because people are afraid. They don't feel, A, we have any privacy anymore. The government is surveilling everything. Obama wants to have the control over shutting down the internet when he or they deem it's there's some sort of national emergency going on. You know, it seems as if the ability to actually cover these issues, you know, is being foreclosed. I mean, how do you cover a war from only one side? I mean, you were just in Afghanistan, Ted. I mean,
by the way, I think that your Facebook friend's concerns are valid. I mean, you know, if you can find the New York Times article talking about how the NYPD tapped my phones. And, you know, I bet they still are. And I'm sure they pay attention to you, too, Danny.
No. I did have earlier in my career when I was paying attention to this stuff more, you know, I did retrieve a large number of CIA files and FBI files and even National Security Agency files about your news dissector's activities in London and in New York, and I actually at one point when I was on WBCN, this was great, a guy comes to me and, you know, says, I'm having a nervous breakdown, I'm really upset. I said, why? He said, I have been reporting on you to the FBI. This is in Boston. I said, what? He says, I said, are you my agent? You know, so I actually wrote a piece about it called Meet My Agent, and this guy had been basically busted for marijuana up in Vermont and was offered a choice of going into the Army or informing for the FBI, and he used to listen to me on BCN and report on what I said every day to the local FBI. We basically confirmed this by actually setting up a meeting that we photographed of him meeting his FBI control person and got the FBI to basically confirm this. So this is not unusual.
I want to ask Ted a quick question. Ted, in the in your book that I'm reading, which is fantastic, and everybody can go to TedRall.com, why do you worry that by writing your book could land you in prison?
Well, there are still sedition laws on the books. One in particular that I quote at the beginning of the book from the U.S. Code that dates back to 1940. And, you know, right at the beginning of World War II, and calling for the overthrow of the government can cause you, which is ironic considering that, you know, the Founding Fathers thought that we should be able to overthrow the government whenever we wanted to, and that it was, in fact, the duty of patriots to do so whenever the government ceased.
Who put that law in the books?
I guess that's an FDR thing, because it's a federal law. So FDR must have signed it, but he wasn't exactly Mr. Civil Liberties back then either. If you ask any Japanese Americans, they can tell you all about it.
Well, you know, I mean,
and don't forget the Germans.
This is true. This is scary. This is dangerous. This is something we need to be concerned about. One way to be concerned about it, of course, is to defend and support civil liberties and human rights. On the other hand, it's also to live in a way in which you're not afraid to ask questions and not afraid to challenge authority and power. And yes, there are risks, but there is also rewards in the sense that at least you're living according to your beliefs and your convictions. So thank you, Ted, for coming back on this week and talking a little bit more about your show. You've managed now to get me on the list, man. I'll be in the next cell with you, it looks like. But thanks again for being with us, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, now we're moving on News Dissector Radio. Here we are, our first time in this time period, 1 p.m. on Fridays, and I'm trying to give you a sampling, a taste of what we do every week for those new listeners who might be joining us. Our number is 888-874-4888, free call if you want to call in. But my next guest has been on the show before and is somebody I respect a great deal, Aaron Crown, who runs the ML-implode.com. website, which you should check out because it carries all the news about the financial crisis that you're not getting in the mainstream media, but getting from a wide range of sources. And Ted Aaron's work in this regard is something I think Ted would appreciate, and I hope our listeners would appreciate. This week, where are we now? It seems like there's been a new development on the foreclosure front, which is quite amazing. Basically, that the many banks routinely had a sort of robo-machine signing foreclosure notices in violation of the law, and that many of these foreclosures are now being called into question. Can you tell us more about that, Aaron?
Right, and that's not the only sort of legal mistake they've made, but in the interest of churning these loans at a very, very high rate, they invented an intermediary called MERS, M-E-R-S, Mortgage Electronic Registration System, which facilitated these transfers and securitizations at a very high rate. And to do that, they basically had to give up following the they call the wet ink note conventions and proper registration of the loans at the local level, proper handling of the transfers of various aspects of legal authority. And basically, they played fast and loose. And they got away with it for a long time, the first two or three years of this crisis. This was a story that was being kicked around online at our sites and other sites.
I mean, you remember that judge in, I think it was Cleveland, where there was a case to Deutsche Bank had come in to foreclosure on properties.
Yeah, Judge Quico. Yeah, we actually broke that story.
Yeah, it was an amazing story where basically the defendants, the people being foreclosed upon, said, okay, can we see the documents? Can we see how do we know that you really have these mortgages? Can we see them? They couldn't find them. And so
right.
The foreclosures were put on hold. But it seems like fraud is really deeply part of this whole real estate situation. I mean, today the New York Times reports in the business section that securitization is back and that the companies are now doing the same kind of loans they did that got them in trouble before. Who's watching the store here?
Well, the people are starting to watch it, and that's why we're seeing some activity here in a positive direction is that people are suing. It takes a while to turn the ship of the legal profession, but some firms are starting to get interested, like that firm Ice Legal in Florida and a number of other ones around the country. And it just takes persistent people willing to fight at a grassroots level, and that's the only reason we're seeing any progress. I mean, Congress is the last to catch on.
One of the members of Congress, though, and I saw this on your site this morning, Alan Grayson from Central Florida, has given basically a speech, a statement, I don't know what exactly it was, if it was in Congress or in his political campaign, in which he explains fraud. We're going to listen to that in a minute. And then I'd like your comments on it. I mean, this is... here's a very gutsy
sure.
congressman.
Yeah, he's been a good fighter against what the banks have been doing.
But he's talking about this in the same terms that I've been using, Michael Moore to some degree has been using, fraud. This is
fraud.
A crime against American people whose homes are being stolen from them without proper due process. Alan Grayson, a congressman from Florida. Sherry, you'll find this interesting. Let's listen.
I love him.
I'm Congressman Alan Grayson, and I represent Central Florida, an area hard hit by the foreclosure fraud crisis. Foreclosure fraud can affect anyone, whether you have a mortgage, are paying on time, have income, or not. The average foreclosure hearing in a Florida court is only 90 seconds. Mistakes are common, and fraud is rampant. Everyone is familiar with dealing with a big bureaucratic institution. What is happening is that these big bureaucratic loan servicers are charging fees inappropriately, refusing to talk to homeowners by putting their calls through to call centers in India, and then foreclosing with forged documents once the homeowner has been drained of all assets and even the will to fight. There's one set of rules for the banks and another set of laws for everyone else. A servicer can ask for fees, it can demand payment, it can send you to one of those call centers in India, and it doesn't have to negotiate. And you now have virtually no rights as a homeowner. Here are four bizarre examples. First, Last summer, Fort Lauderdale resident Jason Gradensky experienced what has tragically become an increasingly familiar process all across America. His house was sold at a foreclosure sale after a bank notified the Florida courts that Gradensky had defaulted on his mortgage. The foreclosure came as a surprise to Gradensky, according to reports from the Sun Sentinel. Not only did Gradensky not have a mortgage with the bank that sued to foreclose against his house, he never had a mortgage at all. Gradensky had paid cash for his home. Second, one house in Pinellas County, Florida, saw two mortgage foreclosure suits brought against it because the banks didn't know who had title to the mortgage. Third, one victim with a perfect payment record of all interest and principal was foreclosed on because of a $75 contested late fee. And fourth, Tim and Nicole West were victims of a predatory loan. In 2005, a bank threatened to sue the couple if they didn't sign a refinancing offer. Their loan servicer has subsequently raised their payments from $1,900 a month to $5,300 a month, with regular forbearance fees required in the tens of thousands of dollars. Finally, the servicer refused to accept payments from the family in the name of negotiating for a mortgage modification. But instead of modifying the loan, their servicer began foreclosure proceedings. The servicer used fraudulent documents to prove that it had the right to foreclose. Here's how it all happened. Securitizing mortgages was originally a way to take the cost of the mortgage off of a bank's books. From 2005 onward, the securitization chain went out of control, and Wall Street wanted as many mortgages as it could get as quickly as possible.
That's Alan Grayson, a congressman from Florida, speaking out on all of this. You can hear the whole speech, the whole statement on YouTube. I have it posted in my blog, the News Dissector blog on mediachannel.org, and you can watch it. It's very important because he's really dealing with this in depth and in detail. And this is something that's been missing, you know, in most of our media, except perhaps on Aaron Crown's site, you know, ml-implode.com. Aaron, what's your feeling about this statement by Alan Grayson?
I thought it was very good, and I think the last case out of the four that he went over really typifies, I think, the bulk of what people are experiencing. And it's really this process of runaround where you're not neglectful, you're in a distressed situation, you're trying to get help. You go through even the government's modification programs that the banks have signed up to nominally. You get this runaround, this wild goose chase. They lose papers. They send you here and there to different departments, and nobody ever knows what's going on. And then all of a sudden, you get foreclosed on. And that really, I think, is the biggest tragedy. You know, people really legitimately trying to get help, and the bank supposed to be legitimately looking at that case and making a modification for everybody's best financial interests. And not doing it because they've been able to get away with it.
Well, to me, this is almost financial terrorism. I mean, if you are a homeowner and you've just lost your job, and the whole financial crisis has really kicked you in the butt, like it has for many people in this country, you know, small business and the like, and then to have your house taken away from you on this kind of fraudulent basis with no place to turn, with nobody helping you. This is really a dramatic attack, you know, on ordinary Americans and Republicans and Democrats, by the way. This isn't a partisan issue. This is an issue which is affecting people, you know, working people who you know, struggle to buy a home because that's where most of their value, their assets value, you know, that they have. You know, they're depending on that home, going to give it to their family, to their children. And suddenly it's taken away from them in these kind of, you know, in this kind of flim-flam manner. I mean, I documented this in my film, In Debt We Trust, back in 2006, about a woman who basically his home was scammed away from her. And, you know, and in Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, you see basically people filling out forms for, in their HUD-1 forms to try to get some help to buy a home, and it turns out that the forms themselves are fraudulent, that 80% of the applicants, you know, are basically caught up in this web of fraud. Nobody's talking about it. And the, you know, basically the movement marching on Washington, they're not talking about it either. You know, and that to me is, and that's why I took on and challenged the person from the march earlier today who basically agreed with me, you know, but this issue is not on the agenda. And so
it's a very touchy issue, and I think you really hit on it, and I've kind of joined in when you made fraud the center of the narrative. I think that's correct. And the other angle of it is a lack of rule of law on the part of the financial institutions of this country. And it's really, I mean, when you really look at the details of what's going on, it smacks of this lawlessness on the part of the banks and then their protectors and the government.
I mean, we can...
Exactly. Last night, by the way, either of you happen to catch Professor William Black, who talked about that 80% of all the mortgages had underlying fraud in them? Did either of you see that on Dylan Radigan?
No, I didn't see it on Dylan Radigan. Someday...
Anything Bill Black says is just pretty much worth watching. So I'm sure
well,
it's good.
The
Bill Black is in my film
that,
Plunder, by the way. Go ahead, Sherry.
The TARP is illegal according to federal law, which is Title 12, Chapter 16, Subchapter 18310, which is
so
the Prompt Corrective Action Law.
So was the Fannie and Freddie bailout.
Exactly. All of this is legal. And what I want to ask you, Aaron and Danny, is why has nobody sued the United States government over this? This is also fraud, what happened under George Bush in 2008.
Right. Well, some of us are trying to, but it's a political game. It's a power game. The what they call the key TAM law firms that sue on behalf, essentially on behalf of the public, the taxpayer, for fraud against the government, will shy away from areas that are politically sensitive because it's essentially through fiat, anything that's politically not viable won't be allowed to happen. So we have to keep pushing from the grassroots to file lawsuits where there is a legal angle to hang the lawsuit on, and there is for a lot of this.
Well,
and then I have a question for both of you. And Danny, you brought up a salient point. Why isn't the mortgage fraud a part of this march on Washington?
Well, again, you know, this is something you'll recall, Sherry, that we tried to suggest to the people organizing the march, and they were very enthusiastic, and then they just never call you back. So it's
that's the way Democrats do things.
It's because
I have to tell you, I think, you know, in the party structure for both parties, and just the government in general, of course, no one wants to let on to how big the problem is. And I think the people of this country want to believe that this is a country that largely has been governed by a rule of law. And it just has not been. You know, as a share of the economy, most of it has just been fast and loose and to the favor of the banks and the financial sector and the fire economy, as it's called. And it's a lot to swallow.
FIRE stands for finance, insurance, and real estate, by the way. Today's New York Times, the lead story, page one, document flaws led to turmoil on foreclosures. Focus on cut corners. Lender's new caution may help stabilize the housing market. So you see, in the end, according to the New York Times, everything will sort of come out okay. Unfortunately, I don't think we have any, you know, kind of faith in that belief, you know, given what's gone down here. But it's also, in a way, the failure, you know, of the progressive movement, in my mind, that's who occasionally listens to me, you know, to take on these issues and to make them part of their agenda. Michael Moore has a new piece out talking about the need for a moratorium on foreclosures, prosecution and indictment of financial criminals. Right on, Michael. I agree with that. But, you know,
well, you know, Danny, I'm a pitchfork progressive brigade. I don't even understand. This has been going on for decades. Where is the outrage, and why don't we get in the streets? Danny and Aaron, weigh in.
This is a southern.
I do. I try to. You know, we try to get people to come out to end the Fed and audit the Fed rallies and things like that. A number of us have been doing that regularly around the country, but we just need to keep spreading the word and getting more people out there and to really understand the core of the issues.
Listen,
and
just, to get the... Go ahead, I'm sorry, Aaron.
Not just, you know, blaring at bullhorns and the like, but really understanding that fraud and the lack of rule of law and the lack of fairness in that sense has been dominating.
See, that's why, you know, I'm very open to a more libertarian perspective, which is, I think, what yours is, Aaron. I think that this is a crisis, a problem that is as dramatic as any problem there is. And
right.
The failure to speak out on it, to protest it, to talk about it, to challenge, you know, is really... You know, something that to be ashamed of, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And
well, movements can turn into or be subject to fiefdom syndrome, and people run them might not actually like the fact that it crosses boundaries, that the real issues cross boundaries like that.
Well, I would just say, and I'm saying this to the listeners here, who hopefully some of them stayed with me after Gary Noel left us, that these are some of the issues, economic justice issues, that I cover and that I report on. I don't just do it from a partisan point of view. I try to be analytical. The other day I was on the air, believe it or not, with Gary Noel, and he was basically talking about the Tea Party. He's done a lot of interviews of Tea Party people, and his attitude was, you know, don't demonize these people. Reach out to them and talk with them if you can, because many of them have basic instincts that might lead them to agreeing with you. You know, that it's
right.
Wrong to just stereotype people who seem to have an opposing point of view as filtered through our media system. And
right.
I agreed with that. I then, on Facebook, got a comment, when will you stop supporting Sarah Palin? and I said, like, where is this coming from? I wrote back to the guy, says, I heard you on the radio with Gary Noel. So people hear sometimes what they want to hear and only what they want to hear. And I think it's a shame, and it's something that we have to challenge. Now, look, folks, I'm Danny Schechter, News Dissector. My email is dissector@mediachannel.org. You can write to me. You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. You can get engaged with these issues, because they are so important. I would like to hear from you. I know there weren't too many callers in this half hour, but that's okay. We had a lot of guests for you and a lot of different views and some debate about some crucial issues, which is the way I like to have it. I don't believe that progressive orthodoxy is any more to be respected than conservative orthodoxy. We have to be self-critical. We have to be aware of these issues. I want to thank you, Sherry Welch, for helping to book this show, that part of it, which stayed booked. I want to thank you, Aaron, for coming on the air and raising these issues with us. We're going to be going out with another one of Polarity One's song, but this is a song that was the oldest song in American history. This is a song that goes back over 150 years, and it really speaks to the aspirations of many Americans and talks about an institution that's crucial to many of us, and it's called Home Sweet Home, and I'm putting it now in an anti-foreclosure context. I'd like you to listen to it. I'd like you to come back next week at 1 o'clock here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and let's do it all over again. Thanks again for listening.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never. same income, the same job, but are losing their home.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market, how can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this.
Naked and that we can't afford to live in our own state, you know, where we grew up, where our children were born, and forcing us to go elsewhere.
Watch out.